This is Terry Gibson, Portal and Psyche, doing individual and cultural Jungian analysis in liminal realms, November 13th, 2009.
I'm Deborah. First time I met Terry, I think, was at the Portal to Psyche, Portals to Psyche. We had that amazing event at the Seattle Art Museum. I don't know how many of you were there. It was pretty extraordinary. And in the fall of 06, I was asked to help organize a trip to Spain to do the Camino de Santiago, where Terry was our main gatherer and our inspiratrix, really. He, over the course of getting ready to go, and I think there's maybe five of us in the room tonight who went on the journey. We did the last 111 kilometers on the Camino de Santiago in Spain. It was an amazing adventure. We were ranging in ages from 40 to... Did Fern have her 80th birthday? We had quite the group. It was her 80th birthday, so from 40 to 80. And what I remember about Terry was what a masterful guide he was in opening the deepening for each of us in the mornings. Our ritual was to have breakfast in the hotels and then meet along the journey where we were beginning in the morning. And then he would be this magical guide using American native chants and some Irish singing. Maybe you had some poetry, some different imagery that we would close our eyes and listen to our own inward journey, and then we would go off for the day in silence. But anyway, just a little bit of Terry, an extraordinary guide, and we just thank you for that amazing journey, and thank you for leading us again on a new journey.
My own feeling about the Camino de Santiago, it includes pilgrimages both in Europe and in Japan. Paris to Santiago, 1,400 kilometers. Interesting. The big Shikoku Island, Shingon Buddhist pilgrimage, from Temple 1 to Temple 1 at the Circle of 88 Temples, 1,400 kilometers. Starts getting really archetypally interesting in that. Two different cultures. If you're a Hindu in Japan or a Peregrino in Spain, the daily rituals are often very similar. Different languages, different faces of the kind of process. And I'm absolutely convinced, more after this trip, that the Camino probably was an ancient Celtic path that the Druids used that was hijacked by Christianity. And a war against the Islamic faith and the religious war. But one of the proofs of that came, one of an interesting little moment, our guy, he started having experience with you all, this assignment, this group. Elena Leonard was the co-leader on it. And about the second day he came to Luna, I said, he had some tears. He says, I take jaded Germans and American groups that just drink and frolic on this. He says, I'm going to have some experience. He says, would you all be interested? I know some Templar churches off the side that I never would you be interested in going to. So he took us to Templar church. And we got this Templar church, and he found a local guy, and the guy opened it up. And it was a woman from Australia, a psychologist. She was over clanking these two metal rods over in a corner. I said, what are you doing? And I came and she says, well, Olympic Dallas Springs and an Aboriginal woman gave me these are dowsing rods. Mm-hmm. Now, if this path is a Celtic path, then I think it's on a ley line. And I think those people, like a lot of the Polynesian navigators, it was third sight. They saw ley lines. So this Templar church was built right on the path. So she had me hold these. And the way he held it, you could not, my muscular couldn't affect this that I could see. When I walked to the center of the church, the apse line, 18 inches on that side of it, these tapes banged out to the side, walked straight through it 3 feet, and they went together, all up and down. And about 80% of the group tried it and had the same experience. So we formed a research project there. We said, well, if the Christians hijack this thing, they claim the path ends at St. James's tomb. The mojo stops there. If the Celts are true, the mojo is another 50 kilometers off to a place called Finisterre, Land's End, which is where the ancient ones used to go and watch the summer solstice and set right off the cliffs. 2,000 feet, stunning drop. We've been there. And the place that I think there's a rock there that you, in the gorse between the large stones of the sun and stones of the moon. There's this stone in there where you can see human bodies laid in this thing. So often they've ground their form into this granite. There's two of them. And my fantasy was an initiate and a sponsor. And my fantasy would be maybe around birth and maybe around marriage rites and maybe death. If people could make it from here to this place. So we kept trying these dowsing rods on the back. We got this idea, and they worked all the way to Tennessee. So we went on the other side. We went out past the church in Kentwood. We went out into the courtyard. And we went about 2 kilometers further on the way to Finisterre, and they were just banging away. So I think that research project, our research project, said it's a Celtic liniment. But it was a great trip, and thank you for reminding me of that and the fun we had. A great liminal show, if you've not seen it, Preston Singletary. Native American trained in Pilchuck and Glass Ark has a just smash up glass show right now at the Tacoma Glass, International Museum of Glass. It's a glass longhouse. It's like going into a Salish Vesper Lodge. It's stunning. This is one of the images. Raven stealing the sun is in one of the back rooms. But it's well worth a whole day to go down and just experience. But I also want to put this in honor of two animals, because we're a community, and two of our animals died in the last 6 weeks. Claire Buckman, which many of you never had an opportunity to know. Everything I value about Jungian psychology was in Claire's life, a woman who served women's social groups until her 60s and then went back and got a PhD in family studies, worked with Virginia Satir, and started analytic training at 67. And went on to become one of our better animals, interested in the reality of the soul and mystical and transformative experience. Believe the Jungian analysis was a gateway to that for all of us. And then got interested in consciousness, living and dying, got ready to really receive her death in a conscious way in her mid to late 80s. Thought she was going to die in a year, and I think it was a little Big Man, the movie where the guy gets all ready to die, the Native American guy, and he goes up to the top of the mountain, there's thunder and lightning, and all of a sudden you hear a voice, after all the hail and everything clear, he goes, oh, bullshit. He's still alive, and he comes out off the mountain, he didn't die. Claire didn't die. And I think she was a little disappointed. I think she was all set, and she wasn't ready. Well, she did die this spring. And she was an exceptional human being. And I'm just thinking a lot about her these days. And she's in the room with us. And then Jess Grossbeck. Jess, an interesting alchemical cocktail. A Mormon, analyst, forensic psychiatrist, and wrote and experienced some of the best papers on shamanism that Jungians have ever written. Jess and I co-participated. Donald Sander was alive, which was kind of the dean of shamanistic study. Donald convened about 40 of us every year. I joined a group after he'd been meeting for about 5 years, and he asked me if I'd join. He and I met, and he said, boy, you need to be in this group. So I met for the last 6 or 7 years that Donald was alive. We'd meet once a year either in the Rockies or in the Bitterroot country. And we'd always invite indigenous Native Americans, we'd analyze. And the question was, how are what we do similar? How are our crafts similar and how are they different? And Donald took the lead in putting those conferences together and just had some of the most consistent and stunning and provocative things to offer. And just a rich fabric and weave of different traditions in Jess's career. So I wanted to honor both of them. And I thought a way to do that is a way to just bring liminal experience out of memory, out of the thing, is to bring a chant. I just want to chant with you all. It was the last chant that I did at our retreat with the animals, and it's a pity song. It's a grieving song. So I want you all to think of all the things you're full of self-pity about tonight. I'd like you to reach deep down all stuff you do, all the crap the world's full of that you're fed up with, and all the things you're fed up with about yourself, all the things about the gods that you're, and all the pity and how pitiful it seems. And it's pretty easy in this world to feel pitiful. And to feel also all the people you've lost in your life, your ancestors, lovers, friends, husbands, wives, children. Loss is the fundamental experience of this world. And I just want to sing and join along as you get the rhythm. It's pretty simple. I'll probably do a tricycle with it. But I'm going to do this as a way to kind of invite Claire and Jeff's spirit to be with us and kind of be with us in that liminal zone, because the big liminal secret we're all curious about, we're all afraid of, is our own death. And I think we need all the support we can try to figure out. That is the liminal event, whatever that portal is. Even had Hume cranky and anxious a lot the last couple of weeks from his life about all the things. None of us are going to go into that experience without lots of questions and lots of concerns. So, and this rally, I've kept it with, when I go to pilgrimage, the one fundamental thing I always throw in my backpack is duct tape. It is just great for everything. I have a roll of duct tape. And this last trip, I had a friend make this rattle for me, and he filled it with seed from Hopi, from the second Mesa community that had been blessed in one of the spring corn rituals. About the third day, I started to hit this thing, and I went like this, and the top, and sprayed everybody with seed. Everybody got seeded, and it seemed just appropriate. So I asked everybody to just pick up stones off the Camino, so all the rattling in here are Camino stones off the path. So. Hey, na, Betty, hey, na, Wakanda, hey, na, Betty, hey, na, Wakanda, hey, na, hey, hey, yo, way. Hey, na, Betty, hey, na, Wakanda.
Everybody's got them all around me. I haven't got mine. I keep emailing Amazon. It's in the queue. It'll come when it comes. But I've been hijacking pictures off the line. So, and you know, that Sarah Corbin article in the New York Times, if you've not read it, it's a really great summary of it. It is the New York Times Sarah Corbin Red Book. And they all sold out the day after that. That's why you can't get them now on Amazon. That article just made that a number one book overnight. But in that article, she says it was until 1985, it was in the cupboard in Jung's study. Well, I had to interview the Sun in 1984 to get access to the unpublished letter file. I was finishing my analytic training, and I was over on sabbatical for 3 months there. And the Sun didn't like much what I was going to write, and so I was supposed to have an hour interview, and I ended up being there for 3 hours. He was trying to talk me out of my thesis, essentially. So we had this, it was kind of an interesting time. But if I'd have known the Red Book was in that cupboard, I think I'd have been cheeky enough to ask if I could have taken a peek. Because you know one of the urban myths, you all have got it, known, but one of the urban myths was that most of it Jung wrote in midlife and his time of crisis and a little bit after. But there's rumors that he returned to it in his last year, and it's rumors, the urban myth was that he had some fairly unsettling apocalyptic dreams about the over-direction of human experience. And so I'm real curious when I get mine to flip over in the last images and see when they were done. But some of you have got it, Jordy, that's not a mystery, but there's one of the newer images out of the Red Book. I don't often agree with everything Wolfgang Gigerich says. He's one of our more provocative, and he's the kind of an analytic bad boy voice right now. He really stirs things up. But there are other things he says that just stir me. He's very Teutonic, and he wanders like Jung. Boy, when it, there's some stuff that breaks out of him. Being can be reached. I wish I could inscribe that on my door. I forget that in a lot of days. We all forget it in this culture. We forget our own being, cultural being, whatever being is, the essence of things. Authentic essence, core essence, can be reached. If there's any central affirmation of Jungian psychology, is that we can reach it. Doesn't mean we will. There's no guarantee that you can spend thousands of dollars on analysis. You can be an analyst, and you may lose your being rather than find it. There's no guarantees. But the promise is there that being can be reached. Tomorrow, we'll see the other side of this alchemical. Everything is from the one. I believe that's true of the local realms that we're going into. Portal and Psyche, doing individual and cultural union analysis in liminal realms. That's what I'm here for, so I hope I'm in the right room. Today and tomorrow. Today, an outline of what we're doing tomorrow, a lot of small group processing and more in-depth material, particularly around initiatory experience. This full PowerPoint will be available after December 7th. The only thing you need to write down, unless you're like me, you're just kind of a compulsive note person to deal with your seminar anxiety, www.pastoraltherapywa.com, all one word, .com. And then it'll come up, and you'll see my name on the left side. Click on it. My page comes up, and you'll see on the left side, private. Click private. And I've joked about this in the past. I don't know what my web persons, what they project onto me, but the username is Terry, and the password he assigned to me is ants. So you type that, and then after December 7th, a PDF version of what I present today and tomorrow will be there. And I always have more material that I'll get to, and I'll include some of that extra material if I think it's warranted and will be useful. A few parameters. Again, I'm not here as an expert. I'm just really fascinated by liminality. And we'll talk more about what that means. Hopefully, I won't explain it, but I hope to get you more curious about it. My model therapy values image and word as the most important gift of culture and psyche, and I think that's where liminal experience is provoked by. And I use a lot of film as I think the most important transmitter and transformer of liminal image and world in our contemporary culture. From the door sill of a dream, they called my name. It was the good voice, the voice I love so much. Listen, said the voice, will you go with me to visit the soul? And a soft stroke reached up and touched my heart. With you always, and in my dream, I walked down a long and solitary corridor, aware of the touching of the pure robe and the soft beating of blood in the hands. Had two people mention that poem to me in the same week. And Mary Oliver, same vein, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal and to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go. To let go. And then Jung, Collected Works, 18th volume. And we've been through, since 9/11, 8 years of cultural hell. My partner and I thought many times of leaving this country. I couldn't recognize the spirit that I saw in the past. The value, the kind of grinding capitalist commodification values. And wars that were approaching genocidal body counts. We were all like stunned cattle. We didn't know what to do. We were just herded in the storm trying to get warm. I've never seen us so stunned. And then a liminal event happened in Grant Park a year ago this month. It lasted about 30 minutes. These liminal events happen usually, and we'll talk more about the liminal things in the cultural realm, usually introduced by tragedy. 9/11. Not so much in D.C., but in New York City, palpable grief was in that city, still is, as a result, a compassionate grief. A space was opened in the void that the Ground Zero kept empty for so long. And I went back a year afterwards. I went to Ground Zero and just talked to people in the buildings, asked them about their experience. And they had talked about it for a year. They just started crying. There was this sense of liminal being. And John Kennedy's death. we all remember those of us who were alive then. And Martin Luther King. Usually trauma will flip a culture, and Kronos, clock time, disappears, and being time kind of shows up from a deeper level. But, and then we had this giant economic collapse. It just seems like all the horse men and women of the apocalypse are beating down on us at times. And Jung talks, he says, the gigantic catastrophes that threaten us today are not elemental happenings of a physical or biological order, but psychic events. To a quite terrifying degree, we are threatened by wars and revolutions which are nothing other than psychic epidemics. And I think the cure for the epidemic, the anxiety, that's massive cultural hysteria and anxiety. War is a massive moment of cultural hysterical psychosis. The only thing to do is to find a liminal opening in that and drop into it, both personally and collectively. I'm going to see a opening clip to kind of just set some liminality. We're going to see it right from the beginning. It's Bernardo Bertolucci's film, Stealing Beauty. There's a lovely Izod essay about this, which will be in the bibliography at the end. But if we can darken the room, let's just watch it and have Bertolucci and Liv Tyler take us into liminal realms. And who is? You have to watch the sound. Hope it gets up. No sound.
We'll be right back. waiting for you to call me.
I got a cab.
Come on in.
Ian, wake up. Lucy's here.
I can't get over how grown up you look.
I hope so after 4 years.
Is Christopher here?
Well, he was supposed to turn up yesterday for my birthday. But he's still floating somewhere around Turkey with his friend Niccolo.
Niccolo Donati?
Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Lucy, welcome. Welcome. Welcome.
Hi. How are you? Ah, I remember all of this exactly, just from 1 week.
My bees. You don't bother them. They won't bother you. See? We fixed up the old hay barn. Only took us 20 years. When we came here first, there was nothing. No water, no electricity. Cost us every penny we had just to buy the place.
So why'd you move here then?
To work. A great tradition of art in these hills. Oh, you've got Alex Parrish, old friend of ours. He knew your mother, too.
The writer?
He'd been very sick. Distressing for everyone. I hope you're patient, because I fumble along a bit. You'll help?
How?
Let me look at you.
Not all the time, I hope.
You won't even be aware. So get settled in. Have a swim. We eat at sunset, but come up before.
It's your slipper.
I suppose so. Do I know you?
I'm Lucy.
I am Guillaume. Enchanté. Here for a visit?
Ian's doing my portrait. It's really just an excuse for my father to send me to Italy. Oh. As a present.
Hey. Where is Signor Bruno? I have a dream to tell him.
You forgot your slipper.
Oh, merci, mademoiselle.
I'm gonna go for a swim. Bye.
Merci.
Thank you.
Jesus, I thought you were drowning. I was wondering whether I was going to have to haul you out or not.
You're Miranda.
You were here before, weren't you?
4 years ago. Your brother was here, not you.
Well, I don't really live here. But we come every year for Mommy's birthday to console her. Christopher's so distracted he couldn't quite find his way out of the turkey.
With Niccolo.
Do you know Niccolo?
From last time.
You don't smoke by any miracle, do you?
Not really.
Richard freaks out when I smoke.
When are they coming back?
Who?
Your brother.
Oh, who knows? They said... Richard!
Hi, Beth.
Oh, and this is, you know, Harmon's... Mummy's friend's daughter, Lucy. Lucy.
Oh, my God. You're Sarah Harmon's daughter. Your mother was a great poet. I'm, Richard Reed. Really, really honored to meet you.
It's my mother, not me.
Yeah, but she made me want to be a poet. I mean, I think it would be great, you know, just to sit around all day and express yourself.
Richard, I never knew you wrote poetry.
Well, honey, I never did. I'll have a creative bone in my body. But I did become an entertainment lawyer so that I could be around creative people, like Miranda.
I design jewelry. I apprenticed with this real asshole in New York. He's a genius.
Is this yours?
Yes, but that was old shit.
You going in?
How is it in there, Lucy?
Quiet as a tomb.
Just first, before we just talk about the images, I forgot to take this one. I'm taking the mic with me, so... What are your images? What are you experiencing, just at a body level? Oh, yes, it certainly. And Bertolucci keeps returning to his. He's almost preoccupied with it. 1968 to 70 France and the Tuscan Hills. Youth is a big issue in Bertolucci. So, yeah, there are lots of evocations of our own youth. Other things in your body experience. It's a little bit of foreboding. There are some foreboding. That's why I wanted to end it there. How is it in there? Quiet as a tomb. And there is foreboding. There's pregnancy and life, and there's death, and there's threat. There's an insane. Where we'll talk about that in a minute. So yes, foreboding. Other things. So some awakening. She's kind of a vitalizing. She's vitalizing presence. She as is to an airliner and a train in a Tuscan villa. Any other just body experiences?
It just made me think of Eros.
Yes, very much so. And it's full length. You know, the Eskimos, when we see snow, they see 25 different things. When we see the erotic, the Greeks saw 25 or 30 different quality. Eros is this incredibly diverse wheel, a texture, a fabric. And I think Jungian analysis is really an analysis of Eros, most profoundly. Unlived and unfulfilled Eros, everything from forbidding to enlivening Eros. So it's a great word for it. It's, yes. And I keep hearing that rock anthem when I wondered Bertolucci or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Yeah. Well, all the names are very interesting. Miranda. I mean, there's... Well, what some themes. What is the biggest theme here?
Beauty.
Well, certainly beauty. Feminine beauty. And did you notice it's almost like Bertolucci filmed the... airplane and the train sequences with a very handheld digital camera. The minute we got to Tuscany, did you just see the way the earth just kind of undulated? Those just the sensuality of the earth was unbelievable.
Only an Italian could film his or her homeland like that. I mean, there's love. He just loved that landscape. I almost wept the first time I saw that when I was in a movie theater. Big 35-millimeter projection thing. It's just stunning. So, yes, sensuality in Eros. Not just Lucy, but the earth. Everything is sensual. The statues, the water, the texture of the air. And, you know, probably there are three places in the world. Tuscany and Provence a little bit, and they're all kind of in a similar zone. New Mexico and here, where the sky gets painted with that kind of sensuous pastelness at dawn and dusk, the way the light is extraordinary. So there's a very sensuous thing. Other things that you notice?
You could almost smell
the air. Yeah, you could, very much. It's very pregnant. It's a pregnant season. It was very much like when we did the Camino in May, and the earth was just exploding. The fragrance and pregnancy and fertility of the earth. And there's a foreboding theme. There is this issue of death. And there are a couple. Where were a couple of the sinister places? Where did we first see something sinister? Huh?
The jets.
The jets are certainly sinister. And even earlier than that, and the train, that strange male figure. What did you do with that? Bracelet, and he's been observing her, and she's even shocked. I saw you on the plane. He's been filming and studying her.
But that's what she's going
to get her painting done. That's what develops. She's studied, and there's almost a discomfort in the frankly sexual way Bertolucci's camera looks at her sleeping body. It's discomforting. The objectifying, and yet it's more than objectifying. There is affection in it, but it's jarring and unsettling the way the camera even stares at her. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Her little child headrest she carries with her, that little giraffe-like. Yes, even in Beauty's Mark. We drool, we snort, we fart. I mean, we are biomechanisms full of all sorts of ugly stuff. Anything else?
The hand on the face woke her up.
Yes, yes.
It was frightening, and then it was tender.
And he didn't give it. He threw it on the thing under the tracks, whatever's in these images. I think what we're seeing here is that this is an initiatory ordeal. She's in liminal realms already. Travel itself is a liminal experience. I think this film begins in a liminal world. We're crossing borders, time zones, cultures. We're crossing generations. We're crossing sinister to the ecstatic. We're crossing the eros of life, the eros of death. There's so many things that are happening in such a tight pact. We're entering liminal realms. It's a great shot of Bertolucci, and that was one of the ones when somebody just caught him when he was blocking a scene. How is it in there, Lucy? Quiet as a tomb. And what a thing to say to kind of a narcissistically preoccupied and inflated kind. That brings him right back down to ground. Quiet as a tomb. The very thing a good puer male is deadly afraid of is anything to have to do with tombs and slowness and death and despair. Liminal tunnel, the long tunnel of trains, planes, and automobiles. Liminality, some writers on liminality say it often experiences, it's like a tunnel between it's from one realm to another. We're thrust through a tunnel from experience to experience. Trickster, there's always a trickster around in liminal portals, and this one's a dark one, a photographer. And is it Bertolucci? I haven't researched this because I don't want to know, but that's my fantasy. It's like Hitchcock. That's the way where he put himself in his film. He's filming her. And he's observing her, just like the artist is. I have no idea. Exhaustion in the descent. Great effort is required. Travel is inherently a liminal, risky voyage of descent, always. That's why people go to so much carnival travel lines and stuff, try to take the liminality out of travel, try to make it all safe. And every time you travel, it's not going to go well. You can count on it. It's intended, a large part of travel is intended not to go well. Because it's supposed to shock paradigms and open up other. And I think it's always a descent. Liminal image, feminine, wolves. Do you see your little journal? I wondered if that was Romulus and Remus and all those things that quickly sped by, full of the sensuality of a late adolescent young adult woman's quite poignant musings about the world she's in. the earth mother of Tuscany, undulating, alive. The landscape is liminal itself, the skin between worlds, dimensions, life and death, earth and sky, masculine and feminine. I mean, that's why Jungian psychology loves Greece so much, and the Greek myths are so alive. If you go to Delphi or Epidaurus, that very much like its landscape, the landscape itself is the habitation of the gods. We live in a part of the country where the landscape itself, for the Coast Salish people, is habitation of the gods. All these mountains are full of stories of creation and dalliance and relation and transformation. And the Siena is the home of Duccio. I've got one of his paintings, and he's a very sensuous painter. It's a strange home of unspoken rages and sorrows, birthings. She walks into this. It's attractive, all these, but it's also kind of sinister and dark. There's all sorts of stuff to be, somebody talked about waking up over here. Sorrows, birthings, dying, deep disappointments in the midst of heroic creative efforts. I mean, those look like Easter Island statues to me on the landscape, almost heroic, the way they're kind of out there. Digging into the unconscious waters, the triple goddess heart jade, that little thing that the jaded jade gives her. But I think about the triple goddess. It's a supplication even before the jaded, emptied feminine. Miranda's a pretty jaded, emptied woman. But the young Lucy knows how to give something to the earth god. She swims in the water, and the first thing she does, she dives, she descends, finds something as an offering on the bottom that she gives to the pool goddess. It's a great association. Pompeii, a living city that was buried alive in the midst of its life by an earth volcano. It's a great liminal image. It's a great, one of the best books on deep feminine initiation. It's a little dated now. But Linda Fiertz David wrote a book on the Villa of Mysteries from Pompeii that's one of the best single reads on women's initiatory experience written by a woman that I think I've ever read in Jungian literature. And I don't know if it's still in print. Is it? And it's a quite wonderful volume. Villa Mysteries, Linda Fiertz David, but the Pompeii theme. There's the Duccio. Isn't he an erotic painter? I mean, he's the painter of Siena. He's their favorite guy. Victor Turner, getting ready for this, I've been thinking about. I've reread a lot of Victor Turner's classics. And Jungian psychology got really interested in Victor Turner in the mid to late 80s, a American anthropologist. He and his wife was as significant as he was, but she was a woman, so she wasn't valued in the scholarship. They co-wrote a lot of their books, but they went to Africa, and they got interested in studying these rapidly vanishing African ceremonials and studying them. And they became impressed with what really happens there. Whenever a young man or woman goes through an initiatory rite, there are three stages. We'll keep talking about this triplicity. There's just ordinary time, South Tacoma shopping mall time. It's just ordinary tax paying time, Senate ruining healthcare kind of time. Just the kind of time we're always in, everyday, ordinary, grind you down kind of time. And then the ritual, people enter a different realm. They dress differently. If they dress up a lot, they get naked. If they're more naked, they get ornate. Behaviors change. What would normally be seen as obscene becomes the normal. But there is this realm of ritual play and transformation that profoundly affects the initiate, and they're exposed to an aspect of their being and community being that stamps and changes them forever. And when they come back out, they're separated, they go in this liminal zone, and then they emerge. They are transformed back into ordinary time, the same as they were before, but different, stamped and different in ways that they will never be the same again. Liminal experiences changes individuals and cultures profoundly. They are initiatory realms. And he said in one of his books, here I wish to show that where transition in space-time is ritualized, normal time, chronos becomes kairos, how it is ritualized, the nature and properties of the ritual symbols and of their interactions gives us clues not only to the cherished values of the society that performs the rituals, but also to the nature of human sociality itself, transcending particular cultural forms. It's not just individual, it's collective. Grant Park last year, we were changed by that. I never thought I was going to see an African-American elected in my lifetime. I wasn't prepared for that. The announcement came at 8:01 on my television. I couldn't stop crying for 30 minutes. I had a lot of people who had that experience. I went to the inauguration. 40% of the people were African-Americans, 2 million people, bitter freezing, largest political group. People couldn't, particularly the African-Americans, couldn't stop crying all day long. We couldn't believe what we were seeing. And that apparently an extraordinary human being, potentially a liminal leader, he's backed away from that this year. I've been concerned. He's backed away from his liminality. But I think there is something exceptional. And he had actually an initiatory liminal dream, which I'll share before we're done here today. He had an initiatory dream the night before he went to the grave of his father and his grandfather that he'd never been to. He had an initiatory dream that I think was calling him out. He was in, I think Obama's been in liminal realms for a long time. John Doerly, who you'll see a lot of this, I won't quote everything, but John Doerly is a Canadian priest, Roman Catholic priest, and an analyst. He believes, like Jung believed, that I believe, that religious institutions don't work anymore, that the gods are not in temples and synagogues anymore. Divinity is in each of us in this room tonight. The Imago Dei, Deus Incarnatus, is in all of us. And the gods need us as much as that we need them. That they are unconscious in their omniscience, and they are even more dangerous than we are when they wake up on the wrong side of the bed. And the only thing that will save the gods in us is if we can bear their incarnation in our being. Their shadow and our shadow, if we can individuate. And you can only individuate in liminal realms. And no longer, the reason that faiths are dying or they get into these extreme reactive modes like right-wing fundamentalist religions, now all outer frenzy. But not a lot of, you can't feel a lot of authentic substance. It feels very anxious and frothy. It's because we're all terrified that divinity is incarnating in all of us. And that liminal event will either survive as a species to the degree that all of us can open up to that liminal experience, or we will vanish as a species, depending on how anxious we get and we forget ourselves. You know, that apocryphal story, I've told it here before, but I've never traced it down, but it's one, again, these Jungian urban myths. But it was either Barbara Hannah or Marie-Louise of France. This urban myth is that they're walking with Jung a couple weeks before his death. And he's cranky and irritable, and it's one of these nights, and there's hoarfrost on the stones by the upper Zürichsee, by the tower where he was, the Balingen Tower. And they were walking, and all of a sudden he stopped, and it was one of those clear, late winter Swiss nights. And he pointed up the clear sky, and he said, you know, geophysicists say there are thousands of options for life as we know it here, the chemistry for the formation of amoeba and protein and human and life. Billions of opportunities up there. You probably saw the paper tonight. You know, they're all excited because they did find 26 gallons of water in that hitting the moon's got apparently quite a water reserve. And it's that hope that we can colonize ourselves because we know this place will be whacked by something sometime. And Jung says, you know, but recently I've had the forbidding thought that the only place in all the cosmos that the warmth of consciousness has taken root is here. And if it vanishes here, it will be extinguished everywhere, and nothing will be left but a cold, empty, universal void. Well, John Doerly believes the challenge is in each of us to incarnate the gods, and we all have to do that. We all hang together, or we'll, as Ben Franklin said, we most assuredly will all psychically hang together, or hang alone if we don't hang together. Jung's theoretical understanding of religion makes of the analytic process a religious event. It recalls the gods to their psychic origin and encourages unmediated conversation with them and within the containment of the psyche. The analytic process, thus understood, is currently to be valued for a number of reasons. The internalization of the gods curtails enmity, bad blood between religious communities bonded by external gods. Let's talk about this religious war we're in. He's hit it right on the head. More than this, Jung's total myth contends that divinity can become conscious only in humanity. This education and redemption of God in history is an ongoing project. Currently, it takes the form of an emerging myth of an extended compassion. Lucy, if anything, her arrival is extending compassion in that community. Her innocence is waking up that community compassion. I encourage you to see the whole film. I won't tell you where it goes. But it's an essay on innocence in the compassio and the face of foreboding events. An extended compassion whose embrace supplants still reigning myths of lesser compass. The analytic process, though confined in the first instance to individuals, is a significant contributor to the now emerging societal myth. Reread that last sentence. Your ongoing individuating the gods within you contributes not only to your well-being, and it may not make you, you know, if you incarnate the gods, you may be driven more mad. That may be your duty. It may bring more suffering on you, and that may be something you have to bear. But it's the implications are not for you to do that. It's not just for you alone. We do it for all of the species on the planet. We may do it for the cosmos. It may be that important. I mean, that's a profound statement. And I'm going to give his paper. He's dense. He's worth reading every word. I ran into John. I went to a conference in Lithuania this summer, the first graduating class of Eastern European analysts after the Berlin Wall fell. They decided to hold a conference and invite all of us, the first European conference, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to hear Russian and Ukrainian and Lithuanian and Estonian analysts. And it was a profound experience. Kind of show up in a room and hear about, you know, these people, and, you know, Vilnius, I was edgy the minute I got off the plane. That Eastern police state stuff is around. A guy saw that I was a greenhorn Westerner. He lives in Copenhagen, but he took me under his wing, and he says, "You look American." And I said, how did you guess? He says, "I don't mean to be intrusive, but," he says, "would you trust me? I'd like to accompany you into town. There's ways to get into town, and there's ways that would not be as fortunate a way to get to town. Can I?" And he guided me about the right buses. And he said, "We've been having increasing beatings." So that was my introduction, my liminal introduction to Vilnius. And then we met in the university, Vilnius University, 1,200-year-old university. And these young analysts now, middle-aged analysts, many of them were raised under Nazi and Soviet occupation. They've only known societal outer freedom now for 15 years. And all the analysis of their analysands is all about that trauma and digesting and processing that anxious, deep trauma. And then, when they were done, moving performance, and I won't mention to protect their privacy, but one of our dearest American analysts stood up and said, he gave a paper that he said, so I really stood up and all this panel, I said, "Thank you for your presentation. I'm very moved by this." But he said, "There's something left out. And I'm treading on very thin ice here." He said, "I want to be respectful. I'm Jewish. My grandparents were raised two blocks from here." And he started to cry. He says, "I've not yet gone to the house. I can't go to the house. And they told me when they were alive, never go to Vilnius. Never return there. So I had to wait till they died. And I came to this conference. But thing you have not mentioned is in 1942, there were 100,000 Jews in this town. Not only the Nazis, but most Lithuanians gleefully participated in their extermination or deportation. Is that ever discussed?" And the panelists instantly began to sob, the ones around the panel, just this kind of cathartic, compassionate grieving. And he did it in such a compassionate way. It was not full of accusation. It was saying, we have to experience the depth of our foreboding and all our individual responsibilities, but where that leads collectively, all of us, and where analytical psychology is going to have to go in Eastern Europe if it's going to be a real psychology. Boy, I'll tell you that. So John Doerly, I met him in the hall. And he says, it's so important for me. He says, "I got to get these papers out. I think our psychology is missing how important this central theme in Jung is, and that it has not just individual implications, but social." And I think John is right. Going to read a poem, and then we'll probably do another. Are we getting close to the hour break I was told about an hour in, you wanted to take a break. Are we about how many minutes? Okay, let me just read this poem. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back. Well, I'll just tell you the film. We're going to one of the most delightful independent films of the last 3 or 4 years, Waitress. But a film wrapped in liminality. The director, a woman, worked in her downtown West Side studio, had just finished the final edits, and she was murdered. So again, liminality, this film is saturated in it. But we're going to see a clip from Waitress. But this is a poem from Stanley Kunitz that I've been carrying around on my iPhone all year. I used to carry these in my wallet. Now I carry them in my iPhone. The way technology goes. But it speaks to me about liminality. Stanley Kunitz is one of our poets in the Northwest. And this poem is a poem full of John Dorley's compassion and deep earth grieving. I have walked through many lives, some of them of my own, and I'm not one. I am not who I was, though some principle of being abides from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind as I am compelled to look before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling towards the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites. I think of Jess and Claire for me when I read those lines, over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? And I'll tell you, in my early 60s now, that's accelerating for me, and that feast of losses of life. In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exulting somewhat with my will intact to go wherever I need to go. And every stone on the road precious to me, in my darkest night when the moon was covered and I roamed through wreckage, a nimbus-clouded voice directed me. Excuse me. Live in the layers, not on the litter. And though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. That's a liminal poem. So take a break. Usually about 5-10 minutes. How? 10. So we'll come back about 8:15.
The model that outlined tonight, where are the liminal portals? I've already been suggesting things. And of course, this is Dorley's Jung. Not only does the psyche exist, it is existence itself. And that is a real affirmation of Jungian psychology. What is lima? We've been talking about it. Well, Victor Turner says it's the threshold between two states of being, time, reality, and experience. I've been using it, I'll go more in the model tomorrow, but I've been talking about ordinary time, chronological time, clock time, and kairos time, or being time, or deep psyche time. The liminal realm is that realm in between those two existences of reality. Individual and collective liminality enters us through traumatic event, I've talked a lot about that, through initiatory event, and through ecstatic event. Those are, there are other doorways, but those in my clinical experience, people come into analysis because they've either been traumatized or they've had a really niggling initiatory event. They're in midlife, they're fired, they get divorced, they get a major illness diagnosis, life slaps them in the face, and they come in traumatized. And it almost invariably, if they want to, leads into a deeper inner initiatory experience. And then occasionally, ecstasy is involved. People come because they... I think most of us actually can deal with trauma better than deep joy in our life. Often deep joy is more unsettling. And I've had some people arrive because they were feeling so good it unnerved them. And they came in for analysis.
That's right.
They were in an ecstatic liminal place. But our culture, you know, and I'll have some models about this tomorrow, but... the key book I mentioned in the outline, that this is its 30th anniversary, Joseph Henderson. who cut back, the urban myth was he stopped seeing 30 patients a week. He was getting a little tired. He cut back to 25 at 101 years of age, but he died 103 or 104 years ago. But in 1969, when he finally got published a book called Thresholds of Initiation, it's a classic book. It's on the bibliography. And then there was another book that was done as a kind of a festschrift in honor of Joseph's work about initiatory activity that came out early, and it was a multi-authored collection of essays, and they're both on bibliography. But Jungian psychology really values, a lot of us see that analysis is inherently an initiatory event, and most men and women in this culture are not initiated. And I believe for most men and women there are two liminal initiatory moments. One is when we leave home, 18 to 24 or so. Or 30 in our culture, I think adolescence goes on to mid-30s. For me, I was an adult doing managing major adolescent issues until my late 20s. But most of these young kids don't have any intact initiatory mentors that know what to do. You, if you're lucky, you stumble into a good mentor. But most people don't even stumble into good mentors. And that's the minor right. The major rights are midlife. And I think for my generation, I think it's different. We'll talk more about the minor rights for women often in my generation were the relational and birthing rights and leaving home. And for men, it was pulling the sword out of the stone and phallically penetrating the world. They were kind of gender-based issues. But then the major initiatory rights for those generations, for women, was to pull the sword from the stone and phallically penetrate life. And for men, it was to do the relational and the birthing rights. And I believe you can't really be a whole human being unless you've gone through both of those poles. You've found the contrasexual element in yourself, and you've found that other initiatory pole. And most people have done none of that in this culture. They've not been given the opportunity. And I think analysis, but I think it can be done in lots of ways. I don't want to drag on, but I've talked before, but it's been 6 years ago now. We've done this 3 times. I've been at a clinical men's group for 27 years now. One of us lost a child and got in really bad shape, and a bunch of men got concerned and said, can we help? And we went off in the mountains for 3 days, and it was such a good experience for the rest of us. We've just all been meeting 3 times a year now for 27 years. One of us children. Well, I have a godson. I have several godsons. The mother of one of my godsons called me 5 years ago and said, he's having a 16th birthday. Can you say something nice? For about 15 minutes. I was by myself in the car and said, well, Roseanne, my first response is, I'd rather not, but if you would give me your son in my men's group, no questions asked, for 4 days along a big weekend, I'd be willing to do that. And if you just have all you need to do is have a big feast at the end and invite a bunch of his friends, and leave the rest of us, and don't tell him about it. Arrange with us, and we'll come and kidnap him. And I'm not sure the guys will do it. I'm just making this up, talking to you on the phone. But if you're willing for us to do it, and she said, I'll have to call you back. And I got a call. She called me in 3 or 4 days. She says, with kind of a quavering voice, she says, well, I think it's okay. And I said, well, I want you to be really sure, because this is a big thing. So she said, so why? These men are amazing. It's my godkid. They invested 6 months to get married for this. They didn't want this. What do we know about this? I said, well, I know. It's kind of an inflated thing. But if somebody doesn't start, how does it happen? So what do we do? So we put together all the stuff that was meaningful for us. And one of my friends is one of the Anglo people community, one of the best Northwest Coast Salish sculptors. He made masks for us. And we arrived and drummed. He had no idea. And they said, you ought to be the one to talk, because he may not go. And we came in, and he was doing his homework, and we said, tonight, Toby, you die. And you must come with us. You have no choice. And we looked at his mom and said, tonight your son dies, Steve. And she started sobbing. They said later, the animals in the house just all went down, a bunch of animals. And he came with us. We blindfolded him, stuck him in a car, and one of my analyst colleagues loaned me his property for this. This is his lovely, wild piece of property. So we took him 2 hours in the dark, he was blindfolded, instructing him about, this is going to be a scary thing, and here's what we think you can do. You're going to be alone in the wilderness for 3 days. We'll come and do some things with you some of the time, but well, here's our suggestions about how to use the tank. And that kid went through 3 days. And when we were done, we were all kind of weeping, probably bawling. 100 people should have gathered. And we took our masks off, and he had a mask on. And he talked about his experience. And we were exhausted, a bunch of burnout women in the corner. And a bunch of young high school kids were, what happened? I've been told I can never tell what happened. So, I have to keep that to myself. But the adults were leaning in. And then I was with my friends right in the corner, and one of my best friends looked at me and said, this was so amazing. But he started to cry. He said, I'm just so sad nobody thought to do this for me. That's the issue of culture, is we're not doing this for each other. So analysis is not the only place this can happen. You can do this with yourselves and your generation. You can initiate some things in yourself by doing it for somebody else. I encourage you, and that was a liminal event for all of us, more for this young man than us. When we sat in the sweat lodges and shared our experience with him, I think it was more cathartic for us than for him. Talking about what is it to be a man in this culture? A good man and not a bad man. Whatever we knew about that. We told him we didn't know a lot about it. We tried to tell him the things we knew about it. And what do you tell young women about being a good woman and being a good woman? And that's the minor one. I think in analysis we see people that get really crippled up about the major one that come in. So they are liminal events. And they touch deep spirit, deep community, deep caring in us. It's always accompanied by the numinal and the synchronous. The gods are always in these liminal events. Whether you want them or not, they're in you. I want you, even if you don't believe it, I want you to entertain the belief you've got the gods in your belly. If every part of your being screamed against that notion, I still want you to go home and be disturbed by that. Liminality is always at the margins, the intrapsychic and extrapsychic social margins, and it always touches our inferiority. Our contempt and shame states always get activated. When you're in a liminal realm, I know I'm on a liminal realm when I'm screaming at the TV again. Recently, I'm doing a pretty good job of my analysis with my self-contempt and shame and intrapsychically, but I tell you, I can still get ahead of political contempt and shame stirred up in me pretty easy. It's pretty easy to happen. And about 3 years ago, I volunteered to not participate in my congressperson's progressive advisory council. And I try to be there in an analytic consciousness and try not to get around. And I try to tell Adam the truth. In a way that I try to be relational with him, but I've discovered he's a good man, and he's really isolated, and he wants the truth. I think most of these politicians, and they're not doing the truth for them. How to tell the truth? And they get their inferiority state when people are yelling at them all the time. Thresholds between two states of being, we've talked about it. Ordinary becomes extraordinary. Conscious daytime becomes unconscious. Night, dream, trance time. The personal can become the transpersonal. I'm going to close with a brief clinical example tonight after the film. Chronos can become Kairos. It's not guaranteed, but that's the hope. And Albert Einstein said, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. I like that. Albert Einstein knew something about synchronism. Robertson Jeffers. If you ever go down to Carmel by the Sea, you can arrange ahead of time. He built his own little tower. Yates had a tower, Hume had a tower, Robinson, Jefferson, they were all building towers about the same time. I don't know what about males in these phallic towers in the 1920s.
He built it for his wife.
Yes, she was.
Don't forget that.
But it's interesting, all these guys at the same time are building these towers. But you can schedule a private, it's a great private access to it. He wrote this poem 30 years before he died in this bed. He knew he was going to die in this bed. I chose the bed downstairs by the sea window for a good deathbed. When we built the house, it was ready waiting. I'm used unless by some guest in a 12th month who hardly suspects its latter purpose. I often regard it with neither dislike nor desire, rather with both so equal that they kill each other and a crystalline interest remains alone. We are safe to finish what we have to finish, and then it will sound rather like music. When the patient daimon behind the screen of sea rock and sky thumps with his staff and calls thrice, come Jeffers. Triple God is calling. He wrote that 30 years before dying in that bed. Liminality is a possible portal in the destiny world. if you enter liminal realms, I believe that not only the gods and us, having done this work for 35 years, I think every one of us have a destiny. I also begin to believe we never know what it is. We just act like we do and we get ready. I'm really more and more entertained the notion that all the things that I, all the time I spent becoming an analyst, all the hours I sit with people, all the time I struggle with my partner and my mother and my dead father and my siblings and my God, kids and wife, it's also that I go to the airport to pick up a family member. On a day when I did my analysis, self-analysis, I did my Tai Chi, I exercised for an hour, I had a good 5 clinical sessions, and I feel pretty mellow, full of some nervous, and I go, and I'm waiting for this family member, and I decide to park in the parking lot, not waiting in the cell phone zone, I'm actually physically waiting for them at the baggage claim. And somebody in that plane had a major life crisis just before boarding, they're devastated, and I catch their eye for just a second. And that catch a glimpse, they're energized. They don't even know about it, and that's all I'm here for. That was the handoff. You know, that's it. I think it can be that simple, but I really believe in the intricacies of things, that everybody has a destiny, whatever this master, the masterwork, this giant project of Deus Incarnatus. Liminality also punctures inflation states. You can't stay self-impressed when you're terrified. You first intuit and appreciate liminal presences themselves. It's always good to begin in utter stillness. What the ancient Greeks called the Shia. And I said beauty and trauma are portals, but politics, pilgrimage, seasons, the moon, sunrise, the national parks, a national park series. I was going to play a vignette, Terry Tempest Williams talking about a trip she took as a kid to the park. It's Ken Burns is our national soul. He is the soulful demographer of the landscape of American democracy and the soul that lives in it. But that national park series is full of touching interactions. Jazz, blues. I grew up with a fairly well-known jazz musician, a turning father. So as a kid, I had a lot of these jazz people go through my home, and they would put me in liminal realms. I hear my dad and Stan Kenton talking about the days on the road or when I met Count Basie. Or Duke Ellington. I was a 16-year-old pimple kid. I didn't have enough to know who I was meeting, this Ellington man. And I remember just being on the world. I was just so, I hated jazz. I was listening to the Everly Brothers, but this guy. And I forgot about it. And then I saw Ken Burns' series on jazz. And Dave Brubeck talked about how when Take 5 started climbing on the charts, Duke Ellington, this African-American, had never been honored by White Society. This gentleman, this giant, asked him to be the front act for him. And one morning there was a knock on the door. Ken Burns has got this on tape. And he said it was 7 in the morning, and there was Duke Ellington dressed in his suit. And he had Time magazine, and I was Man of the Year. And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, congratulations. And we both knew it should have been him on the cover of that magazine. He said, the dignity of that guy. The dignity. That's a liminal moment. Jazz is a liminal blues. Tosca. Love, hate, war, violence, comedy, tragedy. There are all sorts of portals. We all have to enter the labyrinth of our own being. And the liminal doorways are there. And if we turn our backs on them, we miss our own being. My work is revelation, not revolution. Yeats spent his life trying to find those liminal places. And I'll leave all of these on. The numinous is key to liminality. Just show a little bit of this. The hottest YouTube video last year was this thing, time lapse of the Brooklyn Bridge. Moving to all of the traffic. It's liminal watching. It had the greatest hits of any YouTube video in a 2-month period of time. I think people were looking for the liminal aliveness of their own cityscapes. Look at them. Another Red Book image. Cat's Eye Nebula. It's in the heavens. It's inside us. Anne DeVore has self-published some lovely books on her lifelong preoccupation with Yeats and Hume. The soul is the enduring entity. It is the living being who incarnates life after life in many patterns and circumstances. The larger spirit is the self, the evolving entity. It can be likened to a diamond that is being faceted. The soul is the jeweler. In each life, each personality pattern is but one of the facets the jeweler places on the body of the diamond. Each facet serves to bring out the unique beauty of the diamond, and all the facets together enhance the diamond's ability to reflect the greater life. That diamond is in each of you. Anne profoundly believes that. Jenny Holzer is an artist that she paints stuff on buildings and stuff. I'll do this tomorrow too. Some days you wake up and immediately start to worry. Nothing in particular is wrong. It's just the suspicion that forces are aligning quietly and there will be trouble. Those are liminal days. She is an artist about noticing the liminal. It takes a while before you can step over inert bodies and go ahead and learn what you were trying to do. That's what our culture does. We step over liminal moments. She's all of her art blows it up on buildings, but she's trying to stop us. We'll wake up to kindness underneath. I will pluck all time, and times are done. The silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. Yes. Recovering the deep feminine, the earth, and lost innocence is central to liminality. Peter Kingsley, the kind of mystical ancient historian in Greece, the bad boy historian, one day we might be able to help the goddess, but not yet. This is no time for chickens to be running around. It's the hour of wolves, and it's really true. We are in a peck of trouble, personally and collectively. But she's always back there. Well, you want to see Terry Tempest Williams? I said I was going to skip it. Here she is.
For all the bureaucracy, for all the red tape, for all the arguments about public policy,
liar.
Our national parks are first and foremost places of love. And I think each American can look into their own hearts and tell you, this is my national park. And it might be the Great Smokies, it might be Yosemite. For our family, it's Grand Teton. This is the range of our memory. My great-grandfather brought my grandfather, who brought my father, who brought us as children. It's the last place my mother came before she died. It's also the last place my brother took his family before he succumbed to lymphoma. I'll never forget, we were at the Murray Ranch, and Steve and Anne and the girls were walking toward the Snake River. It was pink light, alpenglow, and Steve stopped. And you could see the reflections of the Tetons in one of the pools. And he turned to Anne and the girls and he said, "Mark this moment." And then five elk swam across the Snake River. And I watched this family of five return. These are the stories that allow us to go home and face not only our lives, but even our deaths. That's the power of these remembered landscapes.
Liminality. I don't even talk about that. A liminal moment. Beauty of the earth. O lover of gentle nature, you are to be much praised, generous, courteous, without measure, sum of all goodness. You do not will to do anything, lover without my will. And thus I must not hold silence about your beauty and goodness. Powerful you are for my sake, and wise such I cannot abide. Ah, but to whom will I say it? Seraphim know not how to speak of it. Lover, you have grasped me in your love to give me your great treasure. That is the gift of your own self, which is divine goodness. Heart cannot express this. Hildegard of Bingen. It's in your self-interest to find a way to be very tender. She's an incredible artist. "I'm Awake in the Place Where Women Die" was on the side of a skyscraper for 2 weeks in downtown New York.
Barbara Hepworth, the sculptor, says, I am the sculptor, I am the landscape, I am the form, and I am the hollow, the thrust, and the contour. Latson Hinton, one of our colleagues, has given a paper on Sunday, and he's a guy named LaPlanche, a French analyst, says, all analysis takes us to the hollow, the hollowed out place, and you have to bear being in the hollow. Barbara Hepworth, a great picture of her. She's doing one of her garden sculptures. Another Hildegard. And you must enter the aesthetic. The transformative surround of sorrow and beauty always accompanies these deep experiences. Thomas More said, there's no way to re-enchant our lives in a disenchanted culture except by becoming renegades from that culture and planting the seeds for a new one. Waitress. Set this up. We'll stay in the dark, but just to tell you what you're going to see a little bit. It's a story about a working class woman that works in a pie shop. And her mommy separated from a dad, abandoned them, and so she and her mommy, her mother made pies and made up these exotic names for pies, and her daughter became even a better pie maker than the mother, and she works in this depressed middle class, lower middle class working miner on a diner on a Highway 99 in their region. An Aurora Avenue North somewhere, a pie place, with a bunch of depressed but interesting women and a surly cook that says sexist things at them and hollers at them all day. And she goes home to an abusive husband who's terrified. He's a little kid. He's obviously been abused, but he abuses her, and he keeps her as a mascot. And she's hoarding money to get away from him. And then she gets pregnant. He gets her drunk one night, and she gets pregnant, and she goes to her OBGYN, who she thought was a crone, but that crone retired, and a pu'er doctor's there, and she starts having an affair with that doctor that she essentially initiates. I mean, he professionally goes quite along with it. But she brings pies, and they make love on his desk, and she suddenly has this depressed woman comes alive. But she recognizes deeper things have to be resolved here. And she's... where we see her now is her husband has found her running away money and has beaten on her and driven her back into her life and taken her hope away. And she's got this baby that she resents in her belly, and she wakes up depressed in her house. And the doctor can't forget her, is parking waiting for the husband to leave. And we see them having an encounter. Adrian Shelley is the director that died, finished the last cut. They found it on her Apple computer, and a half hour later, she was murdered. That's the husband.
Pregnant, miserable, self-pitying loser pie. Lumpy oatmeal with fruitcake mashed in. Flambé, of course. What are you doing here?
Took the whole day off. I don't know. Wanted to see you. You look awful.
Thanks.
I mean, you look sad. You look really sad.
It's taken you a long time to notice this, but I'm not a happy woman, Dr. Palmiter. And I don't want you to save me.
I don't want to save you.
Don't want to be saved.
Can I come in?
No. Yeah. So what now?
I don't know. I thought maybe you could teach me how to make a pie.
Seriously?
Seriously.
I could do that. Sure.
Come here.
Thank you.
he just can't.
Dear baby, I hope someday somebody wants to hold you for 20 minutes straight, and that's all they do. They don't pull away. They don't look at your face. They don't try to kiss you. All they do is wrap you up in their arms and hold on tight without an ounce of selfishness to it.
She wants you. We want everyone. And you want her. She wants you.
Once the chocolate's all in, you'll pour the berries on top.
I'll pour the berries on top.
Mama used to call this Lonely Chicago Pie. She made hundreds of different kinds of pie. They all have real strange names, like Car Radio Pie or Jenna's First Kiss Pie. Now the berries. You do it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mom would keep me in the kitchen with her and teach me everything she knew about baking. She'd sing me so sweetly. Baby, don't you cry. Gonna make a pie. Gonna make a pie with a heart in the middle. Baby, don't be blue. Gonna make for you. Gonna make a pie with a heart in the middle. Gonna be a pie from heaven above. Gonna be filled with strawberry love. Baby, don't you cry. Gonna make a pie. Hold you forever in the middle of my heart.
You are so beautiful.
No, I'm not.
You are.
I'm fat.
You're pregnant. Got a little baby growing inside you. There is nothing more beautiful.
It's an alien and a parasite. It makes me tired and weak. Complicates my whole life. I resent it. I have no idea how to take care of it. I'm the anti-mother. I don't want to talk about that no more. I want to know what the hell you're doing here.
I'm learning how to make Lonely Chicago Pie.
No, I mean what you're doing here, living in this town.
My wife. She just finished med school. We came here for her residency.
Are you happy with her? No. Don't answer that.
I'm happy right now. Being here with you.
That's a good answer.
You make me feel calm. You make me feel peaceful. I don't feel that much. I tend to be neurotic. And you're so beautiful.
Keep going.
And so sexy.
More, please.
And I can find the whole meaning of life in those sad eyes.
Wow. Dear baby, somewhere in the space between the pie bacon and Earl eating it later that night began the most intimate conversation of my life. About my mama, about how much she loved me, how sad she'd be to see my life turned out like this. About Earl and how he changed after we married, became someone I feared. About how lonely it is to be a woman so poor, so afraid. And then I was addicted, baby. I was addicted to saying things and having them matter to someone.
How are we doing time-wise? What is the time? 5:02. 10 minutes? Possible to go about ten more minutes? Okay. What are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling like I was there to hold the baby for the 20 minutes she needed it.
Hope. There's hope. Two flawed human beings in a flawed situation that somehow both show up in. It's pretty a touching moment. It's a liminal moment out of very pained time. And we can judge all the circumstances, but they both were kind of equals in this event. They both brought something to the pie making. Any other feelings that you have? Despair on both sides. Their deep neurosis, their deep dissatisfaction, their alienation from their very existence in both of them. And it's the first time probably either one of them have so openly confessed it to anybody. This can happen, not in analyst offices. That's a nice place. But yet this process can happen in so many of the most unexpected and unpredictable. Liminal moments can surprise us anywhere. Even in Nordstrom's. Dan. And he was honest. He wanted to make a pie because it made him feel peaceful. What I really like about you is I feel around you. And he didn't have words. My being comes to me. Kairos comes to me. Compassio. If there's any visual image in cinematic film of compassion, this little scene for me is it in terms of human compassion. And the gods. The gods are in there. The lonely gods are in the room too. Lonely gods wanting to come into the human, be birthed into the human experience pie. Lonely God, Chicago Lonely Pie for God. You know, it's the gods themselves. Anything else you know? And a witnessing presence, this woman, she's poor, she's beaten down in late patriarchy, and suddenly a witnessing container, meager ingredients become everything. There are liminal moments. The noumenal is there, beauty is there out of the trauma, all the things I've been talking about that define a liminal moment. And they get really naked with each other, literally and more importantly, psychospiritually. And they both know this isn't going to last. We know this isn't going to last. I won't give the way, the film is wonderful. There's a cranky old diner owner that is really one of the liminal presences. He's a trickster. He's a Synax Dionysus in the film. He's an alive old guy that plays a key role in it. So it's a lovely film, but it's an image of liminality and compassion. And the you saw what I was talking about, the importance of beauty and sorrow in constellating deep liminal moments. They're both here. Okay, we're going to drive quickly to the end. Even the guy, the nasty guy that runs the diner, she goes up to him after she discovers he's having an affair with one of her best friends, another waitress. Cal, are you happy? I mean, when you call yourself a happy man, do you really mean it? And here's Cal, you know, with his armpit hair and his dirty T-shirt on and he's got his cooking hairnet on. You ask a serious question, I'll give you a serious answer. Happy enough, don't expect much, I don't get much, I don't give much. I generally enjoy whatever comes along. That's my answer for you, summed up for your feminine consideration. I'm happy enough. That is patriarchy. That's the best it gets for most men and women. Men are much more infected by this. That's as good as this culture gets. But even Cal's looking for liminal experiences. And I think he even has some in this film. Baby, don't you cry, gonna make a pie, gonna make a pie with a heart. And you can go home and sing that to yourself. It's kind of an addictive, pregnant, miserable, self-pitying loser pie. Lumpy oatmeal with fruitcake mashed in, flambé, of course. That was her little... great ingredient. Ongoing initiation rites, that's what our life is. That's the liminal will open these. And I'll talk more about this. It's cross-sexual. It's about gender, and I talked about some initiatory stories. All life. This is in the Collected Works, Volume 12. All life is bound to carriers who realize it, and it is simply inconceivable without them. But every carrier is charged with an individual destiny and destination, and the realization of these alone makes sense of life. Liminality gives you your destiny. You've got to be willing to accept the invitation. And you notice there, he says, not human beings, all life. I think Jung felt all consciousness was way beyond just human experience. But it's all about destiny. Ettinger says, beginning animism, this process of warring with the gods in us through matriarchy and hierarchical polytheism and tribal monotheism and universe. But the goal is the discovery of the psyche, and we are at it in our times. Jung said there's basically a fourfold model of how you can initiate yourself. The symbolic process will constellate itself, usually around a trauma or a deep sense of beauty. You have to be willing to descend with it. You have a profound encounter with the non-ego-based, numinous, transcendent source of wisdom and perspective, the divine in you. And there's a process of spontaneous symbol formation and interaction rather than tradition-prescribed ritual. What he means is you have to have your own dreams. You have to have your own experience. And so I want to give you a closing quick case study. And I want you to quickly tell me, you think there's any hope for this person? You think it means in liminal terms. White male, middle-aged, successful, a giant in corporate industry. Been in analysis for a couple of years, depressed, driven into analysis because a spouse suddenly divorced him and felt like his whole world collapsed on him. Secular guy, no organized religious experience, didn't have any dreams, came in almost defied me to pull anything out of him. That was my job, was to pull stuff out of him. He wanted to be there and he hated being there, but he was in a lot of pain. Angry, defiant, passive-aggressive. So we go on for a year, and he takes a trip home for Thanksgiving, first time since he got divorced. It was a terrible trip. His mother was ashamed of him. His father told him he always knew he was going to be a failure. His right-wing Christian siblings told him what he was going to go to hell. Really great trip home for Thanksgiving. Came, and first night back, he had this dream. First night back. After this year of just resisting being opened up, life knocked. All that he had, the descent was there, he was resisting it. And this is this profound encounter, and his own unique symbols were coming him. In the dream, he said, I'm in Port Townsend. There has been a Holocaust. Bad things have happened in Seattle and all the cities. I don't know how desperate, but the dark ones are coming. And I'm building a trench. And it's 20 feet long, 6 feet wide, and Native American style. I'm building logs, and I'm taking my time, even though I know they're coming. I'm deep inside the clear-cut zone. He says those highways up there, they hide the clear-cut with the pretty trees to hide the devastation. I'm in the clear-cut zone, digging a trench and laying these Native American fire logs very aesthetically, because my job is I'm carrying the body of Christ. And it's my job to burn the ashes and to honor them before they get here. I carefully build the fire. I set the body on the pyre. I set it aflame. And I put the ashes in an urn. And just before they break into the meadow, I escape into the Olympic Mountains. And gypsies and fairies are still alive there. And I will survive. And he was weeping. That was the dream. What is, in terms of a liminal event, what do you think of a dream like that? How do you talk about it? What's going on?
To me, it's sort of like
sustenance and nourishment from the landscape, from the earth, which is also like an underworld.
He is resacralizing this devastated landscape, and he's taken his time. He's doing a religious ritual. He's setting out the logs. Even when the dark forces are coming, he's doing a sacral event, which I think was probably his own analysis. It was the trench his life had dug for him and the devastation, and suddenly he was able to do something sacral with it. And who was Christ in that dream? It's his own. It's the Deus Incarnatus. It's the divine in him that he's suddenly starting to honor and rever. And the gypsies and fairies, those are the live earth landscape, the Olympic imagination. It's survived, and he's going to be okay. Pretty good prognosis. Do you think this guy, the pretty good prognosis, he might make it through the therapy? And I think it's not just a personal dream. I think it's really talking about the liminal evil ones that are outside. And that's the collective. I don't know if I can race through this fast enough. I wanted to get to the Obama dream before we... There's a way I can trigger these images and get to the last slide. Here we go. It'll appear right here. Well, can I just put it up on show again? It'll start right. Start right from there. Here we go. The liminal polis. So that dream leads to the devastated landscape. This liminal leader that we have. In his book, Dreams of My Father, this man whose mother was brilliant but fragile and abandoned him, his father, brilliant but an alcoholic and a child abuser, had very little contact with his father, and he goes back to his homeland, goes back to Africa, meets his siblings, many for the first time. They take him out to his home, Home Squared, where his grandfather and his father are buried. En route, on the train, the night before he comes to this homeland that he's never visited, he has this dream. A mama shook her head. That's one of his aunties. Can you imagine, Barack, she said, looking at me, I swear sometimes this leads up to the dream. I think the problems in this family all started with him, your father. He's the only person whose opinion I think the old man really worried about, the only person he feared. We then all decided to turn in. The bunks were narrow, but the sheets were cool and inviting. I stayed up late listening to the trembling rhythm of the train and the even breaths of my brothers and thinking about the stories of our grandfather. It all started with him, Oma said. That sounded right somehow. If I could just piece together his story, I thought, then perhaps everything else might fall into place. I finally fell asleep and dreamed I was walking along a village road. Children dressed only in strings of beads played in front of the round huts, and several old men waved to me as I passed. But as I went further along, I began to notice that people were looking behind me fearfully. Rushing into their huts as I passed, I heard the growl of a leopard and started to run into the forest, tripping over roots and stumps and vines until at last I couldn't run any longer, and I fell to my knees in the middle of a bright clearing. Panting for breath, I turned around to see the day turn to night, and a giant figure looming as tall as the trees, wearing only a loincloth and a ghostly mask. The lifeless eyes bored into me, and I heard a thunderous voice saying only that it was time. And my entire body began to shake violently with a sound as if I were breaking apart. It is the time. And I think we have to come out of the Olympic Mountains and bring the gypsies and the fairies with us and reopen liminal possibility not only for ourselves but for the whole culture. And this work is not just individual, it's collective. It's for compassion. It's for the beauty of the earth. It's to stop mindless military spending. That's how much we spend compared to the rest of the world on military expenditures. It's to serve the earth and the beauty of the earth, to come up with a politics that revers the earth and the deep feminine. An individual's harmony with his or own deep self requires not merely a journey to the interior, but a harmonizing with the environmental world, Jim Hillman. So I'm just going to close with one poem, but just a hope that we can not only do March. 2 million people. When is the end going to come, Terry? Tomorrow I'll show Lars and the Real Girl. Clip will start first thing in the morning. Well, boy, there is more here. I thought I had the closing. But what we all are seeking in this liminal quest is a place on the earth, a craft for the earth, a love from the earth. I think maybe the three things we can have with our destiny, if we realize it, is we really can choose where we live, we maybe can choose what we do, and maybe we can choose who we love. Most of our fate is pretty preset. But that is the goal in this world. There's the bibliography, Joseph Henderson's Thresholds of Initiation, and then The Initiation, The Living Reality of an Archetype. That's the volume that came out in honor of that book. I've been quoting a lot from Richard Palmer and A Liminality of Hermes, and there's a great online article, and you'll see that there. John Izod talked about stealing beauty. A couple of my recent articles that are germane to what we've talked about tonight. And a couple of pieces of music that I was going to share. But this is John Dorley. Marguerite Pourret was to write of her soul, without such nothingness she cannot be the all. A Jungian translation might read, my embrace of the world will never be more inclusive than the depth of my entrance into the mother of the all. In a period when a terrorized humanity looks for salvation from its saviors to avoid its extinction, Jung's myth points to a moment of disillusion in the mother of the all as the ultimate resource to the lethal squabbles between her children, fatally possessed by mere fragments of her always surpassing and redeeming wisdom. This is the wisdom which seeks to become conscious in every analysis, moving through the individual into society. And so I think we can serve not only ourselves and our desperation, but we can serve our society if we open ourselves to these liminal gates and surrender to them. We got to get to the Olympic Mountains to find some peace, but then we have to return and bring what we've discovered back home. And I think that's the challenge of our times. Tomorrow we'll be triad groups, but we're also going to have a film clip of a man who finds liminal experience with a rubber sex doll. Of another man who goes back to a vineyard in southern France and a beloved uncle that he had abandoned. A story about that. And a closing image of a young man who has a neurotic reaction, insomnia reaction to the breakup of a love affair, and discovers liminal experience in a late night supermarket where he has a job. It's a film called Cashback. So those will be three images tomorrow. We'll continue liminal experience. Sorry for going a little bit longer, but I wanted to ground this, not just that it's a liminality, it's not just something we're personally looking for, but we are politically implicated with liminal responsibility. And that dream, I wanted you to hear, that dream was not just about that man's private rage. It was calling him to address the social dangers and to give him a place where he could renew and come back and not just be a whole man individually, but have new capacity to deal with a broken society. See, those will be here tomorrow. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, we go till 4 o'clock in this room. So we'll scatter into the night. Good to see you all. Have a good evening.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.